Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And we couldn't quite resist the Valentine's Day today and President's Day tomorrow, right, Bob?
No.
So coming to you today, we have a taste of the relatively new, just in the last couple of years, new presidential library and museum, Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, that's in Springfield, Illinois. You paid it a visit not too long ago.
Met a woman named Barbara Archer who talked about Abe's life and what Abe might have been eating at the time, what was
okay.
in his garden.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, it's one of the best museums I've ever been to in terms mm-hmm. of interactive displays. They bring in holograms. They really make Abe alive and well. And it's pretty honest, too. I mean, the good and the bad is in there.
Sure.
It's well worth a trip to go see it.
Well, they allow you to sort of get into that temporal context of things, don't they?
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, just like what's going on, what people might be seeing, thinking, feeling. Yeah.
Exactly. It's really well done. And you know, I grew up in Illinois, and Abe was always part of my life. It's funny, Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois.
Yeah,
are
we
three
all
states.
Have a claim to him.
And I've been in all three of them, but they really do it well.
Cool. Okay.
It's a great place.
So, and we'll find out a little plant association as well.
Right.
Plants are always involved in people's lives, so we can pretty much interview whoever we want, right?
That's right. We can go door to door out
That's
there.
Right.
What do you think of this plant, lady?
And we came across this great curator of plants guy, Larry Griffith. He's at Colonial Williamsburg, which
right.
is, you know, Williamsburg is a town, whatever, but Colonial Williamsburg is sort of like Shaker Town, I guess, you know, where you can like go and visit and it's interpretive. And there's
yes.
people doing things that again would put you into the temporal context of the day.
Exactly.
So, but Larry Griffith is the curator of plants there, and he's recently published a beautiful book, Flowers and Herbs of Early America. But we wanted to talk to him about that, but also some symbolism in terms of flowers and their association with love because of St. Valentine's
and
Day.
And love lies a-bleeding, which
love lies
stick
bleeding.
Around, folks, to hear about that one.
That's right. So yeah. That's coming up today on Homegrown. We'll hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I'm getting ready for spring by taking my winter walks.
Mm-hmm.
I literally am out there three or four times a week now trying to get ready
mm-hmm.
for plants and planting. Mm-hmm. And then also lifting a little bit of weights, more than
mm-hmm.
you want to know. But
No, I mean, I was telling you a couple weeks ago how I did a little wood splitting and did
yeah,
and cleaned
thing,
up
yeah.
the garden. And I was so sore yeah. the next day.
I'm trying to unflab myself after.
Uh-huh.
And I always gain 5-6 pounds in winter and it goes away in the spring.
Yeah, helps you keep warm.
Basically, it's great to be out there in the woods because often I'm by myself. I go up to the Charlestown State Park
That's
during
right.
the day.
Uh-huh.
And I'm the only guy there on the trail some days. And boy, you can just see the edges of spring coming up in the ground. And
buds swelling.
The beautiful bark
yeah.
and the white oaks and off in the distance, the conifers on top of the ridges. And when there's high water, there's streams and they come out of the side of the hills.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see during the summer, mm-hmm. but they're up there. And I just sit there and I'll sit on a stump and look around and say, bring on spring. So I'm getting
right.
ready.
Well, and too, I think you've got to appreciate the non-spring too. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like the beauty that's there, and I think
the
that's
winter,
a great
yeah.
place to do it.
It's perfect.
As you anticipate everything greening.
And solitude in the woods is perfect.
Yeah.
I'll have to wish you state.
Well, kind of along those lines, I guess, in that philosophical sort of way, we were walking a Sunday walk like you, Andy and I, getting out, getting some fresh air, and we came across, this was like an early, late morning, early afternoon, and we came up over a hill, and there was a fox.
Ooh.
So we take off running, because, of course, the chickens are out over the hill at our place.
Uh-oh.
So, but we're not really that worried. But the awesome thing about it was, I'm like, Andy, let's track it. Because we could
oh.
track it in the snow.
Sure.
Otherwise, it just would have disappeared.
Yeah.
So we were able to follow its tracks. Because we're always curious which sinkholes and which foxholes that have existed
so
in the past.
You were in Simpsonville before this ended, right?
Well, we're always curious about which ones are still active.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, the big sinkhole, the fox condo that we
oh,
call.
Yeah.
The big,
yeah.
where we throw brush debris in the back. And it's clear that that's probably the one that's being used. But it was just really fun to follow it, you know, and how they meander. And then they're jumping, you can tell, or they're trotting. Oh. And, you know, I can't do that otherwise. Because the first time I thought I was tracking a fox, I think it was just a house cat. But I knew for sure because I actually saw it with my own eyes. So
we're going to get you a homegrown merit badge.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Fox tracker.
I need that.
Janine Wishy fox tracker.
It only works if I have a visual sighting of the beast as well. So anyway, that's what's going on in the garden. Other stuff going on around town. People are gearing up for spring indeed. Thienemann's Herbs and Perennials on Blowing Tree Lane. They've got a couple of sessions coming up February 19th. February 20th and February 21st, learning how to plant like a cool succulent bowl. And, you know, Bob and I are pretty into succulents these days because they're so easy to take care of, especially when summertime rolls around. So that may be of interest if you're not a big water. But I think it takes place 10 to noon on the 19th and 20th, and then 2 to 4 on that Sunday, the 21st.
Yeah, and the Louisville Nature Center has a great event that kind of fits in with our Sibley Guide to Tree book we had on a couple weeks ago. Winter Tree Identification Hike. February 20th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the Louisville Nature Center. A great place anyway.
Yeah.
Easy to get to.
Easy to, over there by the Louisville Zoo on Illinois Avenue.
So give it a try, folks.
Super great place. And then, of course, we mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but check out, if you're interested in learning how to keep bees, the Kentucky Department of Agriculture is hosting several beekeeping schools over the month of February and March. So if you're interested, go to kyagr.com for more information on their programs. All right?
Right.
And today is Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day, Bob.
Thank you. Yeah. Same to you.
Same to
and you.
You
and yours. And
yeah, I didn't bring you any flowers, but maybe after this I'll have some better ideas.
Your sincere, heartfelt words are good enough for me at this
all
point.
All right, good.
And speaking of plants and romance, we've got a perfect guest to talk about historically how all these things work. He's Larry Griffith. He's former garden columnist for the Newport News Virginia Press and is now curator of plants for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation in Williamsburg, Virginia. It's a job that includes conducting research in the dating of period plants, giving tours of Williamsburg gardens, and development of the annual garden symposium. He's also author of a new book from Yale Press called Flowers and Herbs of Early America. Larry, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Let's talk first about Williamsburg. My wife has been there like 10 years ago and is still raving about it, but many people haven't. So kind of fill us in on what it is and what it was and where it's going.
It's essentially the nation's largest living history museum. It's a 300-acre campus with basically an entire restored village, a mile long and half a mile wide, with 400 either reconstructed or actually original buildings. Mm-hmm. We have 88 original buildings, and everything else is built on original foundations. So the footprint of the city is accurate. We used to consider ourselves a decorative arts museum, mm-hmm. and we are that, but we now are living history, which means live interpretation and the interpretation of American themes like women, slavery, you know, class aspects and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, how old is Williamsburg, and do real people live there now and go to work from there?
It was founded in 1926 by John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and he was coming through Williamsburg on his rail car to go to Hampton University, which is a historically black college. And he happened to stop in Williamsburg on the way back, and Reverend Goodwin, who was the rector of Bruton Parish, kind of pigeonholed him or buttonholed him and asked him to look at Williamsburg and the potential there. And Rockefeller got involved and basically rebuilt Williamsburg from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And that was 26 through 1940, when you know the last of the restoration was really finished.
Well, so Larry, what about its Williamsburg and its original incarnation? What are we talking about?
Okay, around 1900, it was a cow town.
Uh huh. No, but like way before that.
In the 18th century, from 1700 to 1780, mm-hmm. Williamsburg was the capital of Virginia, and Virginia was the largest colony of the English crown. Mm-hmm. So Williamsburg was just it in terms of significance in the 18th century. Uh-huh. And then when the capital was moved by Jefferson to Richmond, Williamsburg just fell into a rut, and nothing happened here until Rockefeller came and restored the city.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Let's go back to your interest in old plants then. When did that begin?
When I was five. Really? I've been gardening all my life.
Wow.
And what started the book was the Mars Foundation, the Mars Candy family foundation gave me a grant to explore early colonial flowers and herbs. And what that entailed was me actually taking seeds, planting them in the ground by hand in the soil without the benefit of a greenhouse, and seeing how they actually produced in trials. And I raised about 150 species of flowers and herbs over 6-7 years. And out of those, what was produced in the book basically were those that photographed well. had to get a book out.
And there are many that were photographed well, to be sure. So, hey, Larry, let me ask you this. So you start by starting these plants the old-fashioned way, by seed, naturally. So how did you decide on which seeds, and how did you go about actually finding the seeds? Because I would suspect some of them, you know, may not be as mainstream now as they were in colonial days.
Right. We have 8 plant lists from the 18th century, about 8, that give us a pretty good clue of what plants were actually growing here.
Mm-hmm.
And that plant list has been pretty complete for 40, 50 years. I found 6 or 7, 8, 9 new plants that I could put on the plant list. And as for finding seed, there are a lot of reliable heritage garden centers.
Okay.
But mostly I Google. I found the most obscure plants by Googling.
Mm-hmm.
People always laugh when I say that, but it's the best.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. Well, today is Valentine's Day, so let's begin some of the specific plants by discussing a couple. And again, Valentine's Day did not exist, of course, in colonial America. It's Hallmark invented it, I think.
But, right. Well, it goes back. Valentine's Day, per se, is a Catholic saint's day, but it wasn't celebrated until Victorian times, you know, sentimentally. Right. But a lot of the plants associated with Valentine's Day were grown in colonial times, you know, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
The only one that's kind of a red herring is Love Lies Bleeding. Love Lies Bleeding kind of means hopeless and not heartless. It's sort of it's kind of agony. You know, the imagery is like your heart's been torn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not the best plant, and it's not really a good cutting plant, but there are many others. Love in a Mist is also known as Love in a Puzzle, which to me means complicated love.
Yeah.
You know, there is an element of love, you know, in that. So that's a really good one, and Love in a Mist is an annual. And it reseeds itself easily. It germinates easily.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a great cut flower, but it's a good. It means love. It has those connotations.
And that's nigella, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Love Lies Bleeding is amaranth.
It's amaranth caudatus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it does kind of. You kind of see it flopping over and bleeding the red.
it does. Yeah.
It's the real unhappy looking flower. Actually.
I looked real hard to find any kind of association for love, and I came up with hopeless.
Yeah.
So obviously the rose is the big love flower, and various roses mean various things. You know, you have the bridal rose, the cabbage rose, the maiden blush rose, and they're all vaguely, you know, love, happy love, ambassador of love. If you love me, you will. But any of the roses signify, you know, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially.
So, Larry, as far as you know, is that something that has its roots in, you know, maybe Greek mythology or something like that, or is that something maybe the rose industry has encouraged more than anything else?
Yeah, the rose has been a symbol since Christianity. It's a 5-petaled flower, and it's been associated with the Virgin. But in terms of its St. Valentine's Day association, it may go back to the troubadours, and the language of love.
Mm-hmm.
The rose is probably the most persistent horticultural love symbol that I can think of, and it's got a longer history than just Valentine's Day.
Right. I wonder, too, if it's kind of going back to the notion of hopelessness as well. I wonder if the thorn kind of makes it even almost the better representation, because how things can sometimes
go bad.
Yes, thank you. I was trying to find a nice way of saying it, but yeah, you know what I mean?
I kind of put together this, you know, you have love, and then you have beauty. There are a lot of plants that mean beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the narrative of love, and that's good or bad. you know, love can go bad. So we have things like Strat Carnation, which means refusal, and that was a colonial plant. And the yellow chrysanthemum was slotted love. Very vague distinctions, but you can essentially conduct a courtship if you knew this language well enough to hurt or to love or to sort of
welcome or reject.
Right, right.
So be careful what you send your lover. Yeah. Huh?
Also, we can't forget about the forget-me-not, the Mysotis. It means, you know, forget-me-not or true love. And that was certainly 18th century. Uh-huh. And then the pinks, the dianthus, the red double and the pink single are pure love, pure and ardent love, pure love. So then the pinks are something that you can actually pick and give in a tussie-mussie to someone.
Right. Uh-huh.
You know, I'm thinking of cut flowers.
Right.
What comes to mind for pure hate?
I haven't run into that.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, flowers shouldn't be responsible for something like that.
Right. That's represented by something altogether outside of the plant world, perhaps, Bob.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of very disturbing... I haven't seen hate yet.
Strong dislike, maybe? Thistles, I guess.
Yes. So let's talk about some other love-related, I guess, plants, flowers, things that may relate to other Shakespeare, perhaps, or other ancient writers. Does anything come to mind there?
Yeah, Shakespeare was very attuned to the language of flowers. And he used especially Ragged Robin, which is Lychnis floscuculi. It's a perennial, and it symbolized Ophelia's, she was mad in Hamlet, and it symbolized her disordered mind, her madness in Hamlet. Off the top of my head, I'm a little unfamiliar with Shakespeare's entire glossary plants, but they don't differ very much from what the Victorians were using. I think the Victorians were very aware that Shakespeare was using flowers and pulled on those directly from him, or what they could construe from Shakespeare. You know, the sweet peas, the pansies, the violets, all meant pansy was thoughts, or I think of you.
Mm-hmm. Pensée, to think, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And the sweet pea was delicate pleasures.
Oh.
The violet was faithfulness. I return your love, or the blue-violet was literally just faithfulness. The red tulip, just itself, which is very colonial, because one of William Byrd II was an 18th century colonial plantation owner, and in his portrait, he's holding a red tulip, which is very significant. It's very iconic. Now, it wasn't so much that he was declaring his love, he was declaring his love of horticulture, but the red tulip is a declaration of love, so a bouquet of tulips would be very appropriate. And the red chrysanthemum, again, is just I love, and that's a very easy thing to give, you know, to hand to someone. And what I really find cool is honeysuckle, because it vines the way it does, represents the bonds of love, you know, the intertwine. And ivy, when given in a tussie-mussie or given in a bouquet, is fidelity in marriage, which is very nice, that love is part of that.
And ivy is so persistent.
It's persistent, yeah. And I did find Dittany of Crete is passion. And I think passion needs to be remembered.
Yes.
Oh, passion,
you know,
flower.
Love topics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and many of these flowers and herbs are in your book, Flowers and Herbs of Early America.
They are.
So let's kind of go back to that a little bit. You planted this from seeds that you found or collected over the years, and then take us through how many seeds you planted, how you did it, and how you ended up with your book.
Okay, I took a plot of ground in one of our historic former orchards and created three large square beds, and each square bed was subdivided into 19 smaller plots. So each bed had 19 of my crops, and each of the 19, or the 56, the total number of spaces, I would plant 56 crops. And I had about 95% germination. And I did that because I'd never grown anything from seed before in the ground, and I couldn't recognize seedlings. And if I had these individual boxes, per se, I could identify my crop from weed seedlings, because weed seedlings would be ubiquitous, mm-hmm. and my crops would be where I had put them, you know, according to my maps. And then I judged them on, you know, how long it took them to germinate, how long they stayed in flower, and just how good they performed in the field. And then the criteria that Mars wanted me to establish was how well they self-seeded themselves. And what I found was the larkspur is by far and away the most prolific reseeder. I had 45 feet of larkspur. The subsequent year, I let it go to seed, and it was all over the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point. It was to find plants that would self-perpetuate, which is probably what they were doing in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And then a photographer, Barbara, came, you know, behind me and photographed. And sometimes we weren't in coordination, sometimes we were, and we had enough photographs to do the book. That was great.
Mm-hmm. So how did what you found with starting your seeds, you know, discovering who was really good at perpetuating their species, how has this allowed you to incorporate it into, you know, as the plant curator at Colonial Williamsburg, incorporated into, you know, what you're in charge of in terms of the landscape and representing, you know, what would have been around in Colonial Williamsburg?
What I found was that the procedure of sowing seeds in place,
mm-hmm.
it involves weeding and thinning and watering, is intensely labor-intensive.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were a nurseryman in the 18th century, I probably would have had kids or apprentices or slaves, and it's immensely time-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So for an institution in the modern era, you know, it may not be the method that we choose to do in every garden, but the new plants I found, the plants that I confirmed, will be going into gardens. You know, they are going into gardens now. But I had one volunteer one morning a week, and she just weeded for me. She was great. She gossiped and weeded. Loved it.
See, that's the value of that kind of work.
Loved
it gives
it,
you
yeah,
time to interact with those that are around you.
Mm-hmm. That was really wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Well, are those seeds available now to the public or through like Heritage Seeds, or how can people
actually
get them?
At the back of my book, there's a seed list,
mm-hmm.
and I believe it includes every seed source that I used.
Mm-hmm.
Chiltern Seeds is a British firm, Burpee,
mm-hmm.
Eon Seed, Fragrant Path Seeds, Germania, Heirloom Seeds. Your listeners should probably go to the Monticello website, monticello.org, because they have a very good nursery landscape feature on their website,
mm-hmm.
and you can buy seeds online from them.
That's mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson's home, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the seeds that you, would you say 56, 57 different?
I started out with 56 and throughout
have added more.
Like 150 or something.
Okay, total. So Larry, some of your favorites, you said that larkspur was particularly good at reseeding itself, but what were some of your all-time favorites among those 150?
I was growing stock, which is a Methiola. It's called a gillyflower. In previous times, it's a biennial. It's been part of the medieval mm-hmm. plant lexicon forever. The wallflower
uh-huh.
is very good for us because it's a semi-permanent perennial, but down here, it really behaves like a perennial second or third year growth.
Mm-hmm.
Anything like a sweet pea that likes cool weather is just a bad idea for Williamsburg. I love the Adonis.
Got a beautiful picture of an Adonis.
It's a
in your
beautiful
book
flower. It's easy to germinate.
Uh-huh.
It's pheasant's eye. Is a common name for it. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. a gorgeous plant.
It's a gorgeous plant, and the seeds are big. They're not hard to handle.
Mm-hmm.
And I sowed everything at the same depth. I don't know a 16th of an inch from a 32nd of an inch. I just sort of, you know, everything came up.
Uh-huh.
Well, one I saw here that Janine grows is flax. Talk about that a little bit.
I like flax. It's hard to incorporate into a planting scheme because it tends to flop. But if you've got a small a patch where you can just distribute it.
Mm-hmm.
It's stunning when it comes up. You know, it blooms 3-4 feet. And if you let it seed, the foliage turns bright gold. It really has two seasons of beauty. When it flowers, it's, you know, this brilliant blue. And then when it ages, it turns this golden color.
Kind of like Amazonia.
It's great. Yeah, oh, Amazonia, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And right? corn poppy looked like a beautiful plant, too.
That is really neat. That is mentioned in the oldest Western herbal, which is a Greek herbal. It's a 3rd century BC herbal.
Wow.
And we can follow it from 3rd century BC to New England in the 17th century to Virginia in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lovely plant. There's nothing more silver than the horn poppy in the garden. Maybe just people, just stops people in their path.
When you're out there in your garden in Williamsburg and you're dealing with plants that have been around for centuries, are you sort of transported back in time? Is that being too romantic about all this?
In one sense, yes, because when my garden was blooming, I had 56 or 57 different species blooming, but these are heirloom flowers. We don't like to use the word heirloom because no one knows what it really means, but
right.
These are flowers that have not been bred to unbelievable heights.
Sure.
So the flower sizes tend to be smaller, so the impact of the garden at first is a little bit of a letdown. You get closer and you notice that there are 57 species and all the flowers are different and distinct. And I make the analogy that it's like a twill. You know, you look at a really fine twill,
mm-hmm.
right.
There are all these threads of various colors in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a better appreciation now.
That's great.
Of what an older garden might look like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not looking at 5-inch marigolds. We're looking at 3/4-inch marigolds.
Mm-hmm.
And to my eye, they're more elegant than the 5-inch marigolds.
Huh.
So in that respect, I do. And also, working in the garden, it was just physical labor. I didn't use a tiller. I didn't use anything. I used strings and stake to lay out my beds. And one of our architectural conservators kind of challenged me on it. I said, what's not colonial about stakes and string? Ptolemaic geometry. You know,
touché, right?
I was really aware of this was very basic gardening, as basic as it could be.
And that's why it was more labor-intensive. Huh?
Mm-hmm, very definitely.
Yeah. Well, a lesson in and of itself.
I hope you encourage other people to give it a try, and I think you've encouraged us to do even
great.
More.
Yeah. I think about anything when you're watering, when you're growing things from seed in the ground, watering is almost a daily occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Because until the stuff's germinated and up, that first 1/4 inch of soil can never dry out.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going in 6 days a week to keep the garden, moist enough to get germination.
Wow.
So that's sort of the caveat to this whole endeavor.
Mm-hmm. And worth it. Labor's a good thing.
Yeah, and there are other plants in the book that are not quite as time-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the larkspur did it all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
The wallflower will seed by itself. The candy tuft will seed by itself. But I wanted all my plants to come up at the same time.
You wanted a little perfection within there.
I wanted perfection. I'm compulsive.
That's all right. Well, it's great. It's a beautiful book. We enjoyed the time and the endeavor.
Great. Thank you.
Larry, thank you.
You're welcome very much.
Larry Griffiths is curator of plants for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation and author of the book Flowers and Herbs of Early America. For more information on Williamsburg or Larry's book, or how you can buy the seeds in the book, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, Bob visits the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill. We are all familiar, of course, with the Abraham Lincoln that grew up in a log cabin near Hodgenville, Kentucky, moved on to Indiana where he grew up into a young man, learned to read by the fireplace, went on to Illinois, a town called New Salem, where he failed at practically everything, and then later on moved to Springfield, became President of the United States, And then, of course, we became the martyred man that he's become, the greatest president in the history of the, certainly our country. But I'm here in Springfield today for a little different mission. We're going to find out about Abe, the horticulturist, and Abe, the consumer of food, what he liked to eat, what he might have seen in the gardens of his day. I've got the perfect guest for that. She's Barbara Archer. She's a volunteer at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum in Springfield, which is newly opened about the time of Abe's 200th birthday and is just an incredible place to visit. We'll talk some about that, but it's the best museum I've ever seen in terms of an individual man and his life and what he meant to this country. But we'll let Barbara talk about that first. Barbara, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the museum a little bit first, and what it is and how it got here and what people can expect to see when they come to Springfield, Illinois.
Well, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum was kind of the baby of Tom Schwartz and Julie Cellini. Tom is the Illinois State Historian, and Julie has been on the board of the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency for years. And they started pushing for something like this about 1985 and just kind of tried to keep it alive until somehow we got the funding for it, and the funding of it was national, state, local, and private industry.
This will give hope to people hoping for an East End Bridge in Louisville, folks. It only took about 30 or 40 years to get it built, so it can happen here, too. So tell us about your background a little bit. What brought you to the Lincoln Museum, and what did you do before you got here?
Well, I was an English teacher for years, but I have been on the staff and as a volunteer at Lincoln's New Salem for over 20 years, where there I did a lot of work in the kitchen garden and the herb garden, and also was one of their primary hearth cooks.
Okay, let's talk about the New Salem garden. Again, that's where Abe moved to from Indiana after a couple stops. And he failed a business there, and he met some influential people there, and he moved down to Springfield and became what he was. But the guy had to eat while he was in New Salem, so let's talk about maybe the food of that day and how it might have been grown.
The food that day, most of it would have been grown in what they called a kitchen garden. Everybody would have had a kitchen garden of about an acre, whether it was all at the home or whether part of it had to be out at the edge of town because of space, because an acre kitchen garden should have been almost enough to handle much of the food for a family for the year.
And what might have been grown in the garden of that day?
Many, 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 many things that we currently have now. You would have had small fruits like berries. You would have had vegetables, a lot of root crops, flowers, because flowers were the one thing they had to decorate their homes with, and herbs, both medicinal and culinary, because that kitchen garden was the housewife's medicine cabinet.
Let's talk about the vegetables more specifically, because you touched on something we tend not to think about, is that, you know, we didn't invent these vegetables. Most of these have been around here for a long time. In fact, they probably come up from England with some of the original settlers. So, but some of the food, the names certainly are familiar to people today.
Most of the things would be familiar with the people today. A few of them are not used too much. You have to tell people about them, just because they've lost favor. But we also have to credit Jefferson, Madison, Washington, who brought a lot of things back from Europe. But we would have had a series of lettuces, a series of mustard greens, turnips, green beans, shelly beans, radishes, carrots, celery, celeriac, West India gherkins, white cucumbers, regular cucumbers, parsnips, onions, pear tomatoes. They had no proof for a New Salem period yet that time when I was doing it of the round tomato being grown. Hot peppers, again, there was no proof yet of the green sweet pepper for the 1830s. One of my favorites was salsify, which is the poor man's oyster. It's difficult to work with because it turns black faster than any other vegetable. But it sure can help if you don't want to make oyster stew without oysters. Sweet peas, yellow peas, Swiss chard, broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus. These are all things most people know. The West India gherkin, most people aren't familiar with. The salsify, eggplant. People know most of these. But it was fun to pull the West India gherkins and have them out for display because they were always a centerpiece of conversation. Well, what's that?
Sounds like home. There was also some danger in those days because Abraham Lincoln's mother died of something they called the milk sick in Indiana, which was, you tell us.
Well, milk fever was an illness that one could get from drinking milk from a cow that had eaten of the white cohosh, or sometimes called white snake root, because if they had eaten of that, and every part of that plant is toxic, then they could pass that on, and it would cause milk fever, which could cause death.
And you actually grew some of that plant here, one of the Lincoln sites.
Not actually grew it here, but in the Journey 1 at the museum, which is the Indiana home, there is artificial white cohosh in the yard.
Okay, artificial, that's good. So Hoosiers are safe from the milk sick.
Yeah, that's right.
And let's talk about the herbs you might have found in the garden back then and some of the medicinal uses of those herbs, which, as you said, is actually, that was the medicine of the day.
Basically, the herbs are pretty much what you'd use today. Not too many people use angelica, but it can be used for sweetener, which for people who can't have sugar. Basil, bay, calendula, caraway, chervil, chamomile, a lot of chamomile tea drank in those days because it had so many medicinal qualities. I always like to keep chicory in mind because I like chicory in my coffee, and they would have ground the chicory root for in lieu of coffee. All various types of onions and chives, coriander, costmary, dill, fennel, the scented geraniums, which could be used in cooking as well as for food. Horseradish, hops, they would grow the hops so that they could have, to make yeast.
Also, I think some beer might have gotten involved with hops somewhere along the line.
There could have been some hops beer, yes. In the New Salem area, it was more likely to have been corn whiskey because the fastest means for a person to get their money out of their corn crop was making whiskey. And it was easier to transport.
Was there any sense that Abe was much of a drinker, either wine or beer?
From what I have read and what I've been told, basically no.
Okay, and then another neat facet of the museum here we came across yesterday was an A. Lincoln recipe book. Some of the favorite foods of Abe Lincoln.
Well, actually, the A. Lincoln cookbook is a cookbook developed by the volunteers as a fundraiser. Chapter 1 has to do with all recipes that were either of the period or recipes given to us by descendants of Friends of Lincoln. And in that, we do have one section of Lincoln favorites, and among those things that he liked were molasses pecan pie, brown or white chicken fricassee. He loved corn muffins and fritters, both corn fritters and apple fritters, gingerbread nuts, which is a form of a gingerbread cookie. And, of course, Mary Lincoln's white cake with a cooked white icing covered with candied cherries and pineapples, although some of them, people like me especially, prefer to use the sour cream icing on it.
But there's kind of a neat story behind this white cake, too, that it was made in Lexington for a special guest of the Todd family, apparently.
Yes, when Lafayette visited Lexington and was to dining with the Todd family, a local chef, I believe his name was Jerome, but I don't know about that pronunciation, created that cake for that dinner, so that definitely is a Todd recipe.
And then, of course, one of Abe's favorites was the peach pie, and that's got a Kentucky connection too, apparently.
Yes, after Josh Speed was married, he moved to Kentucky. And Josh was the man with whom Lincoln boarded when he first came to Springfield. And Lincoln loved Josh B's wife's peach pie. In one letter he read reference, he couldn't wait to get back and have more of that peach pie.
Now, the Lincoln home itself, there's not a garden there at that point, but we're pretty sure Abe was eating at that time, too, maybe borrowing from the neighbors.
Well, actually, there were a number of grocery stores in Springfield at the time, but there were also 6 places where they could go to buy their own vegetables and fruits and things to plant. So the history of that, I'm not as clear on as some of the other areas. But just this last year, because of the bicentennial, one of the young men at Lincoln's home decided or got permission, I should say, to put in an heirloom garden. And since not too much is known about what the Lincolns might have grown, they decided to put it into the backyard of the Dean home. Mrs. Dean was a regular winner of competition, and with food competition at the state fair, and her son was a horticulturist. Much of this garden was based on the writings of Simeon Francis, who had been newspaper editor here, was a close friend of Lincoln's, and did have a place from which he sold vegetables. So we know that, I mean, this article of Simeon's, this is what he had here when Lincoln was here, so we know if he used it, we're safe.
And Abe had long arms. He could reach across the fence and grab a tomato anytime he wanted.
That's right.
That's another thing. There's a Lincoln tomato, and there's a Lincoln apple, among other things, named for Abe. And you've had the Lincoln tomato.
I got one of the Lincoln tomato plants at a historical event at Taylorville, Illinois, a couple of years ago. And it's a very good, real small-sized tomato. I mean, not little, but that's a nice size for a BLT.
So those seeds must still be around some heritage area if, of course, people want to grow Lincoln tomato in their backyard in Kentucky.
That's right. And actually, this last year, I did find them at some of the places who were selling vegetables locally last year.
Well, that's something else you think about when you come to these kind of places, that, you know, the modern tendency for sustainable living and growing your own stuff in the yard and raising chickens and beef and cows. It's been going around for a long, long time. Particularly in the New Salem area when Abe first moved up here from Indiana. So let's kind of close by telling us what you'd see at New Salem if you went to visit there and why visitors should come to Springfield and get a little closer feel for Abe Lincoln and all that he represented and was.
Lincoln's New Salem is a real historical site. It is recreated as much as possible as it was in that day, although the buildings were designed by architects who created them as what they thought they would have had. But most of the houses and buildings are built on footings that were there when the village was there. And it is built to show the three parts of the village, the artisans, the business district, and the tradesmen. You'll see a lot of things. You can see everything from spinning, weaving, running of the oxen-driven carding mill, which we have is the only one in the country. So there's a lot you can see and a lot going on, and we have a wonderful summer theater out there.
Well, Barb, thanks. It's been a delight kind of to dip back into Abe's life and history and what he had for dinner.
I do a lot of cooking and what he had for dinner when I'm at New Salem.
And you're still here.
That's right.
Barbara Archer is a volunteer at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum in Springfield, Illinois. For more information on the museum and other Lincoln sites, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy, ready to be humiliated.
Yeah. Well, I'm just the guy to do it.
Yeah.
We haven't had a Bob quiz in a while.
In his bright red sweater.
I've let you off the hook.
Uh-huh.
And being it's pretty close to Valentine's Day and President's Day and Lincoln's birthday.
Can't get any closer.
Even Washington's birthday.
Uh-huh.
I've got my first and last annual, but all-inclusive, Valentine's Day, President's Day.
Oh, my Lord.
Favorite flower and vegetable quiz.
Maybe that'll save me.
Yeah.
It seems like there's far too many things to pull from here, but I'll do my best.
The word's Google.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't have it, though, right now.
Here's the warm-up question, because I didn't want to neglect
vegetables,
because they're important in the scheme of things, too. Okay.
Indeed.
Miss Wishy, which president ate a cucumber soaked in vinegar every day? Martin Van Berplus Van Buren? James Berplus Buchanan? Ulysses S. Often Pickled Anyway Grant? Or Woodrow Woody Wilson?
I was going to say somebody that you didn't include on your list.
Go ahead, you'll be wrong.
How about Buchanan?
Wrong. Ulysses S. Often Pickled Anyway Grant.
Well, that kind of makes sense because he was kind of running around on the road a lot.
Cucumber. He went from clerk to president. Incredible.
It is pretty incredible.
Number two.
Uh-huh.
Barack Obama's favorite flower is the echinacea because it reminds him of the health care, the thistle because it reminds him of Congress, the rose because it smells sweeter than Washington, or the daisy because it's such an optimistic plant.
The daisy.
What?
Oh, no.
The rose.
The rose?
Smells sweeter than Washington.
Huh. Well, that's easy.
Had to work in fuchsias. Fuchsias, as you know, they prefer life in the shade. They just hang around a lot. They don't do much. They often find themselves in crusty soil. So fuchsia was the favorite flower, if not color, of Richard Nixon, George W. Bush, Millard Fillmore, Calvin Coolidge, or Rutherford B. Hayes? That's a tough one.
They're all tough.
I know. Who do you think would like fuchsia, knowing what you know about presidents?
Well, I would have to say George Bush.
Millard Fillmore.
Oh.
What's the difference? What's
soil.
The difference?
That sounds like it would work in Texas, but yeah, I think maybe too hot for fuchsia in Texas.
Which of these statements is true? Or not. Mostly, one of them's true, actually.
Okay.
John F. Kennedy often wore a bachelor's button in his lapel. Franklin Pierce often wore a purple poppy in his lapel. Jimmy Carter always wore a peanut in his lapel.
I want to believe that that one's true, just in my own
Dwight
world.
Dwight Eisenhower had flowers sent to his wife Mamie every day.
That one.
And James Buchanan, who suffered from allergies and was the only bachelor president, had flowers banned from the White House.
I say Mamie got flowers every day.
That was a sucker punch.
Okay.
It was John Kennedy.
Really?
He wore a bachelor button in his lapel most of the time.
Just to trick the girls into thinking he was still a bachelor?
Well, name the girl. I knew if I mentioned White Mamie, though, you'd fall for that.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
Thomas Jefferson was our first near-vegetarian president, famously stating, "I live temperately, eating little animal food, and that as only a condiment for vegetables." As a result, the most common flower in TJ's garden was the rose, the nasturtium, bee balm, carnation, or dandelion.
Nasturtium.
You got it.
Yay!
You're back on track.
Okay.
What's that? One for four.
I mean, I was never even near the track.
I know.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
You haven't even saddled up yet.
Yeah.
One more chance.
Okay.
Which Kentucky-based politician once said, "All my life I tried to pluck the thistle and plant a flower wherever the flower would grow in thought and mind"? Which Kentucky-based politician might have said this? You ready? Jim Bunning.
No.
Mitch McConnell.
No.
Johnny Armuth.
No.
Jerry Abramson.
No.
David Williams.
No.
Abe Lincoln.
Abe Lincoln.
Abe Lincoln.
Yay. I had a hard time seeing any of those other guys saying that.
Exactly.
All right, Bob.
That's it. You got 33%.
That one, I think, maybe was the toughest of all times.
Well, it was a little even more off the wall than usual.
Than usual.
That's my first and last annual.
I'm kind of used to that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, here's your chance to get back at me.
So am I going to make you divine what my Latin word of the week is?
Something to do with colonies and hills. I'm just guessing. In fact,
sort of.
I'm going off to the Andy Mountains in Peru here. Andes.
You are.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this kind of maybe is serendipitous then.
Okay.
It doesn't really have anything to do with colonies, but the word is colonus, C-O-L-L-I-N-U-S.
Okay.
And in Latin, it means pertaining to hills. And Bob is indeed going to the Andean Hills.
I am.
In Peru.
Can't wait.
In no time at all. And of course, you'll be bringing back fabulous stories from there. So we look forward to
that.
I'm
going to bring Bob back first.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay. But first, colonus, pertaining to the hills. For example, astragalus colonus. Hillside milk vetch.
Oh, yeah.
Lupinus alba frons, variety colonus, silver lupin.
Oh, sure. I know that one.
Plagiobothrus. How about that
one? Sounds like a dinosaur.
It does. Plagiobothrus colonus, Cooper's popcorn flower.
Have you ever seen a Cooper's popcorn flower?
I have not. But look in the hills when you're in Peru, okay?
Eat it during basketball games.
And then, let's see, Sissios colonus hillside burr cucumber.
I was called a big sissy when I was a kid.
Maybe
a cucumber.
Ulysses S. Grant liked to eat the bar cucumber.
Yeah, with vinegar.
So there you go. If you see colonists, likely, I mean, honestly, likely pertaining to the hills, up in the hills, but you're likely going to see this plant colonize well. If you look at the profile of many of these plants, they colonize well on the hillside. So somehow, some way, the show has come full circle, I think. All right, colonists pertaining to the hills. But that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Bob's going to be gone, so Sarah Frischner's going to join me. We'll talk about Kentucky Proud, food at the equestrian events, and a whole lot more.
Homegrown is produced by the Lincoln-esque Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.